Boom! I'm Halcyon. It is time for Hug Nation. We are broadcasting live from the West Coast. We are archiving for YouTube and Facebook and iTunes and Stitcher. And I am excited to tune in and connect. A week ago today, during the normal Hug Nation time, I was at Esalen. They had four courses. They had, four tracks, I guess. One was about Burning Man leadership and the Burning Man leadership model. One was about collective impact. A lot of people were related in that group were doing things with real estate and city planning and things. There was one about art creation, and there was one about being a cultural attaché. The fourth one, the one I was in, was about learning to be a better storyteller and ambassador for Burning Man. Outside of being at Black Rock City, I think my favorite place to be in the whole world is at Esalen, surrounded by people who are as fanatical about Burning Man as I am. And with so many diverse experiences, people that work for Burning Man, people that spend, you know, months in the Black Rock Desert doing restoration, for example, have a very different experience as I do. And so it was very cool to compare beliefs and philosophies about the different things related to the Burning Man experience. So I guess I'll talk a little bit about some of the things I learned at Esalen. So I got to be in this course that was taught by Caveat, who is the most incredible writer. If you go to the Burning Man Journal, the most impressive things on there are the things that he has written. And then Stuart Magrum was there, who is a long time burner and is responsible for a lot of what we know. He's in charge of the Burning Man educational programs. And then also Rosie was also there, who is in charge of, has been really pushing for this Burning Man ambassador program. Oh, they don't call it an ambassador program. It's cultural attaché. I was worried that first we'd have to learn French because attaché is not a word I use all the time. So we had, before we even went there, we had this 4-hour video presentation with all these clips and things of things we had to learn and about the history of Burning Man, clips of Larry Harvey speaking and Danger Ranger speaking and all these different quotes of people and photographs and news clips to get a sense of the history of Burning Man. And then when we got there, we were given a binder, which is kind of the Burning Man equivalent of the stone tablets of all these readings and excerpts from books that had philosophy that influenced Larry Harvey and others, and writings over the years talking about all sorts of topics about the history of Burning Man, the challenges that the community has gone through, the philosophies behind it, and a lot about the 10 principles. So as you can imagine, someone like me that spends so much time talking and thinking about these things, the opportunity to be digging deep with these things was incredible. And plus we would have guest speakers would come to our class and share first-person accounts, like Chris Breedlove did this amazing deep dive into what's going on with Burners Without Borders. We had Harvey Dubois talk about the very early days of going to the Black Rock Desert and about her experiences with creating the very first city structures and the very first theme camp structures and kind of the challenges that helped shape the city over the early days. And so these are things that, you know, 10, 20 years from now, these are going to be history of Burning Man. And we got to hear it as first-person storytelling, which was incredible. And honestly, I learned a lot. I mean, I thought I knew a lot about Burning Man, but I learned a lot. For example, do you know that the 10 principles did not exist until 2004? And the way that they came to be was the Burning Man regional program, the regional network was starting to grow, and the regionals were, they looked to the organizations like, hey, how do we tell people about Burning Man? Like, we need some help. Like, how do we talk about this thing? It's like, we don't really have the language. We don't have a manifesto. We don't have a description. It's very difficult. And so Larry Harvey went on like a little retreat to Mexico to stay with Rod, who is the Rod of Rod's Row. It's the Surround Center Camp. He's a kind of legend in the community. He helped build or create the first city structure, and just a master craftsman who's trained a lot of people. And the reverence that people talk about Rod is really beautiful. But so Harvey went to Rod's home in Mexico and came back with these 9 principles. And everyone said, 9? That's crazy. You got to have 10. And so he took a break, came back and said, okay, the 10th principle is immediacy. And I learned a lot of things that I didn't originally get about the principles. For example, the 10 principles were not written as rules for the community to follow. They were observations of things the community was already doing. Larry Harvey would try to get a concept and a grasp and a recognition of what this community was already doing. And so then he tried to document what the community was doing, how it was already acting. And if you realize, the principles are not values, they're behaviors. In fact, I never occurred to me until they pointed out during this class that leave no trace is not a principle. Leaving no trace is a principle. Participate isn't a principle. Participation is a principle. These are actions. These are things that we do as a community, not things that we're told to do. They're not dictates. They are behaviors that we do. Beneath the behaviors are values, but they are behaviors. And I just like, oh, wow. And I think it's just so cool that these not come from on high. These came from the ground up and then were just recognized. One thing that was interesting, you know, the 10 principles beneath, there's a statement, you know, like a radical self-expression. And then there's words beneath it that help explain it. And I think a lot of people are not very familiar with those words. I know that as we studied them, I realized that there was a lot to those, the extra text that really clarifies some things and really takes some of the gray out of it and also adds some gray. And there's actually, if you look at participation, the end of the participation, I wish I had it written down right here, but there is an element of consent written already into the participation principle. And another thing that was pointed out that we studied that I thought was fascinating that I hadn't quite recognized is that the principles are intentionally, by design, a little contradictory. And they create a energy and like a tension that you can't just follow them. They require you to be engaged and to think and to engage with the community and to kind of be actively be a part of it. You can't just follow the rules because they're not rules. And they're sometimes contradictory. Like radical self-expression is not always totally in line with civic responsibility or leaving no trace. They work all together. You can't just follow one and have the same magic happen. It's the integration and the interaction of all of them that makes the city work. And I didn't fully appreciate that until we were doing this deep dive into it and looking at how, you know, and then we would look at some scenario and then say, well, how do different principles affect this? And how in this challenging situation, how can you lean on the principles to maybe get out of a dilemma? So it was fascinating. I am aware that it is insane, it is impossible, it is naive to think that anybody can tell the Burning Man story based on their experience, because it is a fantastically unique experience for everyone. And so as I got to listen to other people's experiences, it helps me to, I think, be a better ambassador, a better attaché for the community. And I have a broader understanding of what Burning Man is and can be. Let's see, other things that I learned there. In the early days of the event, the first man was Larry and his friend Jerry, I believe. Is that right? I should have brought my notes with me. And then at one point, it got wind of, Larry went to a party with people in the Cacophony Society, and then the Cacophony Society got excited. Cacophony Society, if you do not know what that is a massively important part of the story of Burning Man. Cacophony Society was a group that was a spinoff of the Suicide Club that was a group in San Francisco that was all about culture jamming and doing just like making people think and really like snapping people out of default world stuff. They would protest movies in ridiculous ways, like children's movies, and say that they were satanic. They would break into underground storm drains and then have formal parties. They would climb the Golden Gate Bridge and have tea parties at the top. They would do all sorts of just wacky things. And one of their principles, one of their things is you may already be a member. And that was the precursor to radical inclusion. All of their events were free. A lot of the principles are down relatives or offspring of the habits and rules and the way that the Cacophony Society was run. In fact, it was when I think it was the third. Don't quote me on any of these numbers or any of this. Think of this as conceptually the way that I remember. Whenever the last visit to Baker Beach, the police intervened before they got to burn it. And at the time, the Cacophony Society were planning an event that they were going to go to the Black Rock Desert. They would throw these events where they would go to some place and they would pretend like they were going to another planet. And so they had this event planned to go to the Black Rock Desert and said, why don't you bring the man and we'll burn it there? It had far fewer participants that were going to the beach because it's a big effort to get out there. But they went out there, and they had to store the man briefly in a parking lot. And so it was a parking lot, like a paid parking lot. And so they paid for a space, and they put the man there, like in the back of a truck. But the legs went into a second space. And the owner of the lot, instead of like, I don't know, writing a note and saying, you owe me for another night in this spot, they cut the legs off of the man, so basically destroying it. So they had to repair it. And then they brought it out to the desert as a part of the Cacophony Society event. And then that grew and grew and grew and grew. In 1997, the event was held. They couldn't get a permit. They were kind of being punished by the BLM, and they made up some BS excuse. And so the BLM didn't give them a permit, and so they said, fine, we're going to do it on private land. And so they went to Fly Ranch, and they rented the property there. At the time, they were offered the ability to buy the property for $350,000. Side note, they just bought the property for $6 million. These are roughly these numbers. But they had no money at the time. Keep in mind, they couldn't even buy a second parking place. So they decided to rent Fly Ranch, thinking, great, we don't have to deal with all these the federal rules, and learned it's way more difficult to do it on local land and have to deal with local ordinances and the local sheriffs. And had all sorts of things happen. Like the local representative, the sheriff, came out and presented all of the rules that they had to follow. Actually, it wasn't the sheriff, but they were given all the rules like that they had to follow, which I think was created after, I think they're called the festival rules, which were rolled out nationally after Woodstock as a way to kind of avoid people throwing these kind of events. And there's crazy rules for an outdoor event. Like they had to have lights on every corner. They had to have flushing toilets. They had to have all these city things, these things that would be present in the city, and they were requirements for this event. And so they worked and worked and worked and built and built and built and built and eventually built enough relationships that they either created enough things or, you know, made enough friends that they checked off the boxes and let them have the event. But it was still way more hoops than if they did when they did on federal land. And at the end of this event, at the end of 97, the sheriff and a group of official thugs, or, you know, like people dressed up in like SWAT type outfits, helicoptered in, and they were collecting money at the gate at that time. The sheriff came in and basically confiscated the box office and took all the money, which I think was $400,000. Yes. And because he said there's fees that you guys are going to pay, we're just going to take it now. It took all the money, which then Burning Man had no money to pay any of their vendors or anything else. And if it was a point where this could have been the very end of Burning Man, Larry Harvey got up on any platform he could find and made this impassioned speech over and over and over and said, we're out of money. If anybody can spare $5, $10, it'd be so appreciated. And if you give us $500, you have a lifetime membership to Burning Man. And they were able to raise enough money to pay their bills and not go under. I hope I'm getting my timeline stuff right. Anyway, there's so many fascinating things with the history of Burning Man, and there's so many times when it could have all fallen apart. It's not mandatory to know any of these things to appreciate Burning Man. But it is interesting as to recognize that so much of this institution, you know, happened organically as human beings, passionate people just kept showing up and doing whatever it took to make it happen. And also while doing it, also giving enough freedom to the participants to not control it so much. You know, so that even in its state now, it's so much a result of its participants as opposed to a curated experience from the originators and founders. You could easily attend Burning Man for many, many years and have no idea who Larry Harvey is. There's a ton of people that are massively influential to the way Burning Man is created. The people that, you know, create the city, the people that in charge of DPW, the people who do the theme camps and the placement. I mean, there's so many things that Larry Harvey is not a part of, but maybe just helped manage in some way. You know, there are people that said that in some ways, like as influential and as important as Larry is, there's a lot of things that might be much easier now, because Larry was such a strong person with such strong ideas and identity that there are things that could flow in different ways, as well they should. This should never be, Burning Man should never be a community that is personality driven or created. And I don't think it is. So while giving credit to his vision and his perseverance and his ability to pull exciting people into an exciting project is absolutely something that we should celebrate and honor. It's not, you know, Larryville. And the words that he shared and the philosophies that he brought into it still ring true. In fact, I think that there's even some extra strength and extra power to him. When you watch some of his videos now, it's kind of got this reverence to it that, you know, as a person walking around the event, he's got all the flaws and all the idiosyncrasies that all of us have. But in death, there's a little bit of a specialness that he's kind of the his words have a little special tingle to them that I think could be great for the event, as long as we don't put him on a pedestal and celebrate him. And that was something that at this event was really important. There's reverence for this human being who dedicated his life to this event, but also recognition that he didn't do any of it alone. He didn't build the main man. He didn't build, you know, he didn't construct the city. He was a part of all these things, and he drove a lot of stuff and brought people together, but this was not his show. It still isn't. So, you know, there is the ability to honor his contributions, as well as total faith that the community and the event will not dim in any way with his physical presence not a part of it anymore. I love you. Have a beautiful day.